This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. August 28th marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. You don't have to say any more than that for folks to know these days what that march was about. But at the time, what was going on? The lone surviving speaker from that day is Atlanta Congressman John Lewis. At the time, he was 23 years old. He was the national chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Congressman Lewis joins us now. Congressman, welcome back. Good to have you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You met with President Kennedy, you and other march organizers, back in June of 63. He was not entirely enthusiastic, was he? What did he say to you, and did you yourself say anything to him about the march?
Well, the president said to us as a group that he didn't think we should be bringing hundreds and thousands of people to Washington. He thought there would be violence and chaos and disorder, and we would never get a civil rights bill through the Congress. But it was A. Philip Randolph, our spokesperson, the dean of black leadership, a labor leader, civil rights and human rights leader, spoke up and said, "Mr. President, this would be an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent protest." And the president responded by saying, "I think we're going to have some problems." But we left that meeting with President Kennedy, and we came out on the lawn of the White House, and we spoke to the media and said we had a meaningful and productive meeting with the President of the United States.
And at the end of that meeting, had he at least come to some acceptance that the march was going to happen?
Well, the president sort of said, I think we're going to have problems, but we left a meeting, and we made our statement, and a few days later, we met in New York City, the six of us, the so-called Big Six, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and we invited four major white religious and labor leaders to join us in issuing the call for the March on Washington. So it was 10 of us that issued a call and became the leaders of the March on Washington.
People now think, oh, there was this sort of unified flow to everything that happened. But at the time, there was a great deal of debate among the Big Six and among other leaders about what tone to strike and what to say and what not to say, wasn't there?
Well, we had all planned to deliver speeches, and it was not to be in support of a particular piece of civil rights legislation, but civil rights legislation in general. President Kennedy, some of us felt, had presented a bill that we thought didn't go farther enough. As a matter of fact, I said in my original speech that I thought it was too little and that it was too late, that it was not anything in the proposed legislation that would protect women and children involved in peaceful, nonviolent protests.
You also had a phrase in there that said, "We will march through the South, through the heart of Dixie, the way Sherman did. We shall pursue our own scorched earth policy and burn Jim Crow to the ground nonviolently." That phrase was taken out. What did people say to you about that phrase, and why did you in the end decide to take that out, even though it was a call for something bigger than the civil rights legislation at the time?
Well, several leaders of the march came to me, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and A. Philip Randolph, two men that I love and respected, two of my heroes, my inspiration. And Dr. King said to me, "John, that doesn't sound like you. Can we change that?" And Mr. Randolph, A. Philip Randolph, said, "John, we come this far together. Let's stay together. Can you delete that?" And the Archbishop of the Diocese of Washington was supposed to give an invocation, and he threatened not to give the invocation if we didn't delete the phrase that included marching through the South the way Sherman did. And for the sake of unity and staying together and just keeping us all focused, I made the decision to change it. And rather than saying march through the South the way Sherman did nonviolently, I said we'll march through certain cities, not just in the South, but throughout our country.
Looking back on it, do you think that was the right thing, to take that line out? Do you have any regrets about that at all? Because it's a very passionate, colorful line.
I don't have any regrets. I wanted unity that day. I wanted all of us to be together. And I was looking out for a unified effort for all 10 speakers and the 10 leaders to be reading from the same book.
As you were walking toward the Lincoln Memorial and you realized hundreds of thousands of people were walking with you, what went through your mind? It must have been, for all this planning, you probably couldn't imagine the scope of what was happening.
Well, I tell you, as we were walking and seeing hundreds and thousands of people, I knew then it was going to be more than 50 or 60,000 people. And I saw all of these young people getting up in the trees to get a better view of the Lincoln Memorial and of the podium. And I saw many, many people with their shoes off and their feet in the reflection pool trying to cool off. And it was just a moving sea of humanity. And I was gratified, and I think all of the leadership, we all were so pleased, because we thought maybe we would have 50 or 60,000 people, but the estimate was 250,000. And when I look at the photographs today, I think it was more than 250,000. I think it's probably was a 500,000 people.
At the time, though, did you think, wow, this is better than we expected, or did it dawn on you that you were making history?
It did say to me that it is much better than we expected, and this is probably the largest crowd ever to appear in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln. And I felt by the time that Dr. King had finished speaking that we were making history, but I didn't think it was going to be that significant until many, many years later.
And it was that I Have a Dream section of that speech that, of course, made it the historical moment that it became. Would it have been as big, as effective as it was without that section of that one speech that he inserted really at the suggestion of Mahalia Jackson, who was standing right near him?
Well, that section of the speech was so appealing to the heart, mind, and spirit of so many people. It was all-inclusive. He was saying, in effect, I have a dream, and this dream is in keeping with the American dream. And he was inviting all of us. And it didn't matter whether you were black or white, Latino or Asian American or Native American, to share and participate in this dream, that you become part of this dream to make America better, to make America the America that she should be. And I would say 50 years later, people all over the world know Martin Luther King Jr. They know something about the March on Washington. And many young people, many young children know the speech, and they can recite it, I Have a Dream.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember hearing that he had tried sections of that I Have a Dream message in some other speeches before, but it wasn't in the original text of the speech for the March on Washington, and that it just came because singer Mahalia Jackson said to him, tell him about the dream, Martin.
Well, Dr. King had spoken some weeks and months earlier in Southwest Georgia, and he talked about a dream. And later in June 1963, about 2 months before the march, he led 100,000 people through the streets of Detroit, and he used a great deal of that speech that he used on August 28, 1963.
Had you heard it before?
I heard him talk about a dream, a vision, and many, ministers and religious leaders, sometimes they preach, and he preached that day. He preached, and he turned those marble steps into a modern-day pulpit. And that was the way to do it, by saying, I have a dream today, a dream that is in keeping with the American dream. And he was saying that you too can dream of a better America, a better way, and not just for African-American, but for all American, and not just for American, but for the people of the world.
Do you remember what went through your mind and what you were feeling when you heard him start to preach that way and you were looking out at this sea of people?
As I was seated there, listening to him and watching him, I was more and more inspired that we had to go back to the heart of the Deep South and work to end segregation and racial discrimination, to see that children get the best possible education, to end segregation in places of public accommodation, to bring down those signs that said white men, white women, colored women, white waiting, colored waiting. He lifted us, and we were ready, especially the young people, to come back to Georgia, to go back to Alabama, to go back to Mississippi, to go back to Tennessee and work, because we have been lifted and inspired by this man. And when he got to the point and passed I Have a Dream and started talking about let freedom reign from Stone Mountain of Georgia, Lookout Mountain, Tennessee, and from every mountain in Molehill in Mississippi, we were ready to march again, not just in Washington, but throughout the South and all over America.
And your speech prior to his was really a call to action. And as you said, his was, it was a call to action, but it was preaching. It was framing the whole thing within the context of the American experience. As you listened to it all, did you think, wow, we've got a great combination here?
Oh, I felt it was the right message, set the right tone, and it made it possible for many people who had never heard Dr. King speak, and for many young people that had a desire to make a contribution. He was saying, in effect, that we all can do something. This is part of the American dream. This is part of what makes us Americans. It was a call to reflect, but it was a call to act, not just the participant, but for the president and for members of Congress.
But, of course, the Civil Rights Bill was not passed until after President Kennedy had been assassinated. Did you think at the time of the march, all right, now things are going to happen, and were you disappointed or disillusioned that it didn't happen right away?
No, during the march and shortly after, I was very hopeful and very optimistic. But Dr. King taught us to take the long, hard look and to remember that our fight, our struggle was not just for one day or one march or one season, but it was a struggle of a lifetime. So after the assassination of President Kennedy, it was a sad and dark time in our country, for those of us in the movement. And just before he was assassinated, 2 months earlier, been the bombing of a church in Birmingham where four little girls was killed. But we didn't become bitter. We didn't become hostile. We didn't lose hope. We kept the faith. And I think we were true to the calling of Martin Luther King Jr. and true to the mission of President Kennedy.
It was then Vice President Lyndon Johnson who became president and got this legislation passed through a very difficult vote, particularly in the Senate, if I remember right. Were you surprised that a son of the South, a Texas politician, would be the one to actually make it through? And did he give you any indication at the time of the march that he might be in a position to do this, even as vice president?
I was somewhat concerned about what President Johnson would do, being from the South and being a creature of the United States Senate. He had been the majority leader. But he made a commitment to the leadership that he would pick up where President Kennedy had left off, and that he would do everything in his power to get the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, almost as a living memorial to President Kennedy. And that's exactly what he did. He told some of his Southern colleagues, he said, I'm going to do it. If you're not with me, just don't stand in my way. And President Johnson used everything that he had with his Democratic and former Republican colleagues to get the bill through.
At the time of the march, though, he was vice president, but he was still, as you mentioned, former majority leader in the Senate. He was the presiding officer of the Senate as vice president. Did you have any idea in August of 63 that he would use any of that clout to push the legislation through?
Well, I didn't have any idea, but I think with the assassination, he had to step in the role as president and follow what Kennedy had said much earlier in a speech in June of 63, that the whole question of civil rights was a moral issue.
Looking back on it now, 50 years later, did you think at the time, you were just 23 years old, that you would be looking back on this march as a seminal moment in American history 50 years later?
If someone had told me that 50 years later that I would be looking back seeing this march as one of those turning points in American history, I probably would have said it's just another march, one of a series. But the march on Washington of 50 years ago changed America forever. And the number, the magnitude of the crowd, the makeup of the crowd, it was so diverse that it inspired political leaders to stand up, to speak up, and speak out. It inspired religious leaders, labor leaders, to find a way to get things done in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion.
There's a whole generation now that was not around for the March on Washington. There are people who've come to this country. You speak to so many people. What do you say to them that would help them understand what it was like at that moment in history?
I would say, as I said to people all the time, another generation of ordinary people use our Constitution to move their feet, to speak up, to speak out, to make some noise, to petition their government to bring about a nonviolent revolution, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas. I think this march shaped and molded a whole generation of leaders. I hear and talk to people that are younger than I am, some older, but some that was very, very young 50 years ago said, listen to Martin Luther King Jr., seeing the hundreds and thousands of people on television, just hearing Dr. King's voice on the radio, changed them forever.
And you were a part of that. Could you?
Well, I feel more than lucky but very blessed that I had an opportunity to participate in that unbelievable effort.
Atlanta Congressman John Lewis, the last survivor of the series of speakers at the March on Washington 50 years ago, August 28th. Congressman Lewis, thanks so much for giving us this time. We really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, sir.